When it comes to small grains, for me, I always like to focus on quality. Somebody's got to eat that. And so I've always focused on quality over quantity. And so being able to mill it ourselves, I can take that extra pride in the quality that I've grown. Yeah, our yields aren't the greatest, but I know that what that person is going to purchase from us, what they're consuming and eating at their dinner table, is of utmost, some of the highest quality stuff that they're going to have.
Welcome to the 377th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. When I traveled to the farm of Peter and Brittany Haugen in western Minnesota on a recent day in mid-July, I knew I was getting close when I spotted patches of yellow, ripening wheat amidst a sea of deep green corn and soybeans. Up until a few years ago, small grains such as wheat and oats had been missing from the Haugen's rotation. This is typical of the agricultural landscape in the upper Midwest. The disappearance of small grains from most Midwestern farming operations is due to several reasons, including shifts in markets, government programs favoring corn and soybeans, and disease problems. Once a particular tipping point is reached, it doesn't take long for the entire infrastructure supporting a small grains crop, from planting and harvesting to transportation, storage, and marketing, to evaporate. Pretty soon, even the knowledge around growing and handling such a crop is lost. That's too bad, because small grains can not only help diversify the farm economy, but when rotated into row crop systems, they build soil health and break up pest cycles. They can also provide a wider window for integrating soil-building cover crops into a farming operation. Around 5 years ago, the Haugens committed to bringing small grains back into their corn-soybean rotation as a way to transition more of their acres into certified organic production and to build soil health. They soon became enamored with ancient grain varieties such as Emmer and Eichorn wheat, which are known for their nutritional content. But it didn't take long for the young farmers, Peter's 43 and Brittany is 37, to be reminded of why so few of their neighbors are raising anything other than corn and soybeans. The conventional commodity marketing, handling, and processing system that dominates does not reward farmers for raising a crop known more for its flavor and nutritional content than its productivity. So, never shy about experimenting, the Haugens decided to create their own specialty small grains infrastructure, so to speak. In 2022, they launched Sand Hill Mill, an on-farm processing business that uses a stone mill to produce flour from the grains they produce. Along with the flour, they now market a Sand Hill Mill branded pancake mix, as well as a brownie mix, along with wheat berries. Peter and Brittany have been blown away by the demand for high-quality products made from the small grains they raise. Not only are they able to sell through local food hubs and retailers, but they're shipping product across the country. They see this demand as an indicator that when given a chance, eaters will support a diversified farming system that goes beyond producing raw commodities that are exported out of the community, taking economic benefits with them. Since starting the business, the Haugens have invested in a small grain cleaner and were able to get a Minnesota Department of Agriculture grant to support the milling enterprise. They have plans to build a larger, permanent grain milling system and are excited about the possibility of eventually setting up a test kitchen. After I toured a wheat field and a stand of streaker oats they're growing, the Haugens showed me around their impressive on-farm milling facility. We then sat down to talk about why they're taking their commitment to small grains to the next level by becoming so deeply involved in the food chain. Make no mistake, there's been some significant challenges to not only raising small grains, but processing them as well. But it's become clear that Sand Hill Mill supports the farmer's commitment to soil stewardship, producing nutritious food, and providing economic opportunities for the next generation. Peter started our conversation by talking about how they first came to see small grains as an important factor in their farm's success.
So I started farming 24 years ago, corn, soybeans mainly, and we have some livestock around. But the small grains were more of an afterthought, an as-needed crop for straw. Not much for the grain. Just the sentiment, not just with me, but with other farmers around, is small grains is a hassle, especially trying to sell it commercially. The elevators would dock you for different things, and you'd have different diseases or different pressures coming into it. So you'd have to spend money on fungicides or insecticides, and pretty soon it wasn't profitable. So it just made it very difficult growing small grains. And that went by the wayside over the years and got less and less. And then I wanted to get into cover cropping and cover crops following a full season corn or beans in our climate this far north was difficult. So I went back to small grains, trying to incorporate cover crops with the livestock for grazing. And that was good, but I was still frustrated with trying to sell the small grains. Mm-hmm. I actually stopped growing small grains for probably 4 or 5 years until I transitioned acres to organic, just some small acres, and my organic certifier suggested I use small grains or have another crop in the rotation. So I talked with my seed supplier and basically said, send me some small grains. I need to have a third crop in my rotation. I don't care what it is. It's probably not going to be worth anything anyway. Just give me something to grow. And he introduced me to ancient grains like einkorn and emmer and spelt. And that piqued my interest. I like doing things differently than others. I like trying new things. I like testing things. And yeah, so I researched a little bit and asked him, where do I sell this at? And he said, well, that's up to you. You know, I can't sell it for you. So I brainstormed a little bit and came up with the idea of a mill, because I didn't know of anybody else at the time that had a mill in western Minnesota and was milling small grains, specifically ancient grains. So I pitched the idea to my wife, Brittany, and she thought I was having a midlife crisis. Mm-hmm.
Of course.
And thankfully, before the mill showed up, she came around and agreed to it and said, yeah, that sounds like fun. Let's do that. That's the journey back into small grains, I guess.
Well, and Brittany, you thought he was having a midlife crisis, but I think it sounds like, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you had a little bit of interest because of the nutritional aspect of that's something that you're really interested in. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, I've always enjoyed baking, cooking, that type of thing. In fact, growing up, my mom always disliked it. I was like, hey, can we try XYZ recipe? And she was not big into trying new things in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. So that was, in fact, I think for my 12th birthday, they got me all the ingredients needed to try frying donuts. And that was like one of the best birthday gifts ever for me. And so then we'd also been kind of looking at, well, how can we get healthier food? What is all in our food? And I was like, well, if we can mill our own grains, we know exactly what's in our bread, what's in our flour. I never looked at the ingredients on a flour bag until we started milling our own, and it's gross. Yeah. So it was kind of like the perfect marriage of Pete's love of farming and trying new things with agriculture and my love for trying new things in the kitchen. He gets to grow it and mill it, and then I am the tester.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because too many times farmers forget, especially with the big commodity-based system, we are raising food. So I think to have that reminder, it would be one thing if you had a ready-made market for a particular grain you're going to raise, but having you saying, well, this is a food product, let's raise it. And you just showed me the mill, your stone mill here. And one of the points you made, Peter, was the emphasis on using a mill that's going to bring out the quality in it. And that's something we forget, because the modern system is based on quantity kind of thing.
Yeah, 100%. You know, so many people focus on efficiency. How can I be the most efficient to get the biggest yields? Because at the end of the day, we're paid on yield, right? Mm-hmm. How many pounds of grain did we get? How much did we produce? Because you're going to get paid per bushel or per pound. And when it comes to small grains, for me, I always like to focus on quality. I wanted to have a quality product, something that I could be proud of, and because knowing somebody was going to eat that. My dad always said, you know, he had a guy that he worked for when he was a kid, well, you better get that to town before the mice get it. Somebody's got to eat that, you know. So that's always stuck with me. Somebody's got to eat that. And so I've always focused on quality over quantity. And so I'd get frustrated personally hauling it to the elevator. Yeah, I got a premium for my grain because it was quality, but then they would just dump it in the bin with everybody else's grain. And, you know, there was no identity with it beyond that point. And so being able to mill it ourselves, I can take that extra pride in the quality that I've grown. Yeah, our yields aren't the greatest, but I know that what that person is going to purchase from us, what they're consuming and eating at their dinner table, is of utmost some of the highest quality stuff that they're going to have.
Give me a little rundown of all the different kinds of grains that you're either growing now or you've kind of experimented with, or and even maybe some stuff that you're thinking about experimenting with a little bit. It's quite a variety.
Yeah, so we've got the corn and soybeans, you know, the staples. That's what most people in the Midwest grow. And then I also have alfalfa. We have a cow-calf operation here and goats. So we utilize alfalfa there. But then on the small grain side of things, we do or have done golden flax. We're trying some oats this year. We've done multiple different wheat varieties. To name a few, there's einkorn, emmer, red fife, turkey red, Dillon, bolus, Jupiter, Arisman. We're looking at getting into durum or some type of a wheat for a pasta flour. And then also some of the new varieties that are coming out. NDSU has got some interesting varieties that I'd like to try, as well as spelt, another ancient grain that I'd like to try. We've tried some millet and sorghum with mixed results. I've not been able to mill any of that, but I'd like to try that again possibly, just to get some on the gluten-free side, because we've got some people that have gluten sensitivities or need some gluten-free flour. So, you know, you got oats or buckwheat, corn, some different stuff like that that you can mill for the gluten-free side. So being able to bring sorghum back in as well would give us another type of flour for different nutrient levels.
At the same time, you know, we've been selling our stone milled flour at events and whatnot, and we've actually been talking with people who will come up and say, I can eat stone milled flour. I can't eat flour from the store. My stomach can't handle it. My body can't handle it. And so they said, you know, the doctor thought we were sensitive to gluten, but we're thinking it's maybe we're actually sensitive to the additives in commercial flour. So that's been an interesting conversation we've had with a lot of our customers too. Like, I think we want to try flour again, wheat again, mm-hmm. Which would you recommend? And, you know, do you think it's the additives? Do you think it's the gluten? Well, we're not doctors. We can't. That's a conversation for the customer and their doctor. But once they're cleared, definitely try, you know, non-commercial flour.
Well, and that's maybe something we should clarify for folks who aren't familiar. What is the difference between stone ground flour and what we're the kind of the how it's ground or how it's processed in the what we're getting through the regular stores, that type of thing?
Sure. So commercial flour is run through a roller mill or like a grist mill, and that typically strips away a lot. Well, they have to take a lot of the nutrient-dense portions of the grain out because it's not shelf-stable. Well, because they're taking those nutrients out, they put additives back in. Sometimes they're natural, sometimes they're synthetic, and a lot of bodies can't digest that. Where a stone mill keeps all three parts of the grain together, the bran, the germ, and the endosperm, and we grind it really fine. Sometimes we sift off some of the bigger particles of bran to make more of a sifted or all-purpose type flour, but that is important to keep all three of those parts together. We've actually learned from a professor out west that you need the bran, which has the fiber in it, to digest the gluten in the wheat. And so it's like there's a reason there's three parts and why they should all stick together.
It's a kind of taking a holistic approach. I really like that, where you realize maybe people are so, they glum on so easily to, well, we got to find this one thing that's causing this. And so then they maybe make it, do an additive or whatever. But you're looking at it from a big picture point of view of, well, maybe we take a few steps back and it's the way it's processed. And maybe we look at some of these ancient varieties, that type of thing, and kind of take three steps back a little bit. It sounds like that's something you guys kind of think in that holistic manner.
Yeah, our tagline for our mill is nourish like you mean it. And we really do mean that. Like, we don't want people just to have filler in their body. Mm-hmm. And going back to the ancient grains, we kind of stumbled into that, like I said, with our seed dealer introducing me to that. And the more we researched that, the more we were intrigued by it, because the ancient grains are a different protein structure. And so they're a lower gluten content. The gluten actually comes from the proteins changing through the process of the dough mixing with water. So it's not that it contains the gluten, it contains the protein structure that creates the gluten. And that gives it the elasticity, the rise, and that stuff through the baking process. So that's where some people are able to eat the ancient grains, even though they have a gluten sensitivity, and not have that reaction to it. And then once you get away from the ancient grains, you get to what they call heritage grains, which would be your red fife or turkey red. Those are grains that are more modern, but they're pre-hybridization. And wheat was hybridized in the 1950s. And that's where you get your modern wheat varieties that now are shorter in stature, have some disease resistance. Maybe they're baked for different qualities and stuff. And through that hybridization process, they change the protein structures. Some people don't mind it. Some people can have it, and some people can't. And it's just been an interesting journey that we've been on, finding all of this out. And I've learned a lot more about flour in the last couple of years than I ever thought I'd know in my life.
Well, I was impressed. You were showing me the mill, and you showed, and I was like, "Boy, this—he knows quite a bit about flour here for someone who's out here farming." Can you take me a little bit through? So, your marketing—it sounds like you're marketing almost, or you're marketing all of the small grains, except with the exception of the oats. I think that they're going to a bigger processor, but your other small grains are all going through this stone mill. Is that correct? And talk a little bit about the marketing end of it. How all you're doing that, and who your customers are, that type of thing?
Yeah, so when we started out, we just thought it'd be a small project that we did on the side to help get a few acres of wheat and be able to market it and not lose a lot of money at it. So we thought we would just have some neighbors buying it or local people do farmers markets, that kind of stuff. And then we realized very quickly after my wife built the website that we were getting contacted by people from a distance. And pretty soon we were shipping flour to different parts of the country. And that was pretty cool. And we started shipping flour to Texas or California and getting comments from people like, "Oh, we really love this." And they thought what we were growing and how we were growing it was a great, great idea. And they liked the flavor, the bakeability of it, everything. And then we were contacted by another country overseas that wanted to purchase grain, the whole grain from us, not the flour, because we sell either the wheat berries or the flour through our website. And so we were starting to get contacted by people for the wheat berries. So it's not just a market for the flour itself. And that's kind of what opened our eyes up to maybe trying some other grains and mixing in some other things. And then contacting some other processors, malting companies, just various places that are looking for the grains that we're growing.
That must be kind of satisfying to hear. It sounds like you hear directly from customers. It's a little different than when you take corn and beans to the elevator.
Right, yeah. I mean, people contact us quite frequently via social media or through the contact form on the website. So it's really neat to kind of hear their story, you know, or they'll call and just say, "My husband has experienced XYZ, you know, we want to try some local grain," or "my children, blah, blah, blah," you know. And then it's even fun because I encourage people, "Okay, now when you take this home and bake it, bake with it. If you have questions, call me, text me," because I love, you know, helping educate the people how to use it, because fresh milled flour absorbs more liquid than your commercial flour. So you have to really either know your recipe or know how to adjust it to get the right consistency. And so that's even been fun with a few local sourdough bakers. We gave them a sample and the ones that turned out like a brick, it was dense, "I'm not gonna buy it anymore." Well, through some more education on social media, she's like, "I'd like to try it again." And now she's become a repeat customer. Ah. She's like, "It works up great in my sourdough bread," you know? And so it's just kind of learning how to work with these local grains or, you know, non-commercialized grains. Mm-hmm. And it's been fun getting to know our customers in that manner and helping them provide nutrients and nutrition for on their table.
And you, what are all the different products? You have pancake, go through all the products. Yeah.
Well, we have the flours and the wheat berries, but then we've also developed a brownie mix and a pancake mix. And the pancake mix is whole wheat and it uses our einkorn and it's actually sugar free. And when I first made it and sampled it or tested it on my family, I thought, I was going to have to throw a pizza in the oven just because sugar-free whole wheat, I didn't know how it would go. And they kept gobbling it up, but they stopped after like one or two pancakes because they were full. Huh. The protein content in the einkorn is so much higher than the protein content in commercial flour that they were full. And they weren't asking for snacks a couple hours later. So it stuck with them. And I'm getting better now, but it took me the longest time to not make a double batch of pancakes. Because we would eat maybe a quarter of the stack because we were just, they're filling. That yeah. protein content, that nutrient-dense food was filling our bodies.
So I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about the cropping system that you have set up. So the kind of what it takes to, and my understanding is you kind of have a parallel operation, part of it's organic, part of it's conventional. And you've got corn and soybeans, I think, are still pretty prevalent on the operation. But you can you talk about kind of in a typical year? I know there's no typical year, but kind of if there's a pattern emerging of kind of the rotation you have or the mix that you have on the operation a little bit, Peter.
Yeah, so on the conventional side, it's basically a 50-50 crop rotation of corn, soybeans. I usually don't ever follow corn on corn or beans on beans. I love rotation. I love diversity. And I'm trying to get small grains or wheat back into that side of it just because I have personally seen the yield benefits to corn and soybeans with having that third crop in the rotation. Mm-hmm. So it's trying to get back to that if I can. Now, I am starting this year working with Soil and Water Conservation District as well as NRCS on getting some cover crops following the corn and beans to try to get some of that root structure, get some of that diversity in the soils. I'm leery on it, not sure how it's going to work, but we're going to try it anyway. I'm experimenting with it. On the organic side, I do the corn, soybean, wheat rotation. And just recently I've been starting experimenting with cover crops following the wheat. And I like that because you get a little longer growing season for that cover crop to take hold. As long as you get some rain in August, you know, late August or September, you get some height to that cover crop so you can get some added benefits to that. And especially on the organic side, I'm limited what I can use for a nitrogen source. So I end up purchasing a lot of my manure as turkey litter. And I'm trying to, as I try to increase my organic acres, I can't just go to the, you know, local co-op and buy more turkey litter. They don't have it. You know, it's not like commercial fertilizer. And my supplier doesn't have more barns or doesn't have more turkeys. And so, you know, I'm limited as to how much turkey litter I can purchase. So to get more acres, I'm experimenting with a nitrogen-fixing cover crop following the wheat that I can plow down and then hopefully reduce the amount of turkey litter I need to apply and still get the nitrogen requirements for my corn the following year. So in a sense, it's almost like a four-crop rotation every 3 years of corn, soybeans, wheat, and cover crop, then back into corn again.
One of the things you mentioned was you, because you are kind of experimenting with not just a variety of different kinds of small grains, but varieties within, say, different kinds of wheat, for example. So you joked a little bit that your boys have gotten really good at cleaning out the combine. So I imagine that's a challenge, you know, something like that. But what are some of the other challenges of, you know, there's a reason people got out of raising small grains here in this part of the country, and there's a reason people are hesitant to maybe get back into it. But what are some of the challenges that you've found with it? And I guess, how have you overcome some of those?
Well, the big one is probably just the cost side of it. You know, wheat it costs less to put in, but you don't get much back. So your return on investment, a lot of years, a lot of guys don't even make money growing wheat. So if they're not going to make money growing it, they don't want to do it. I think that's probably the biggest barrier is just the production side of it and that return on investment. But beyond that, you have so many different diseases that can come in and toxins that can get into the wheat. So to meet that food grade, you really have to watch your quality. We've had some instances in the past where we get avomatoxin, which is a fungus on the wheat berry. So to try to find somebody that can remove the avomatoxin or to be able to handle that so that you can make it food grade, we had a lot of difficulty with that, and we ended up actually going out and buying a cleaner so that we could do it on site to remove that avomatoxin and at least have some product that we can mill. And so we've had some success with that. But yeah, I think a lot of it is just, it's more work. And we're starting to see a lot of farmers, especially the younger farmers that are getting into it now, who aren't familiar with small grains. They maybe remember their grandpa did it when they were a kid, but their dad never did small grains. So they're just used to corn, soybeans. They maybe don't have the equipment to handle small grains. They don't have the knowledge to grow those small grains. And they don't want to try something new. This is how my dad did it, so that's how I'm going to do it mentality. It's a scary environment. You know, trying something new, you don't want to fail. We're so afraid of failure as a society that you don't want to try something new because you don't want to get laughed at. You don't want to be the talk of the town for something negative. And I guess I don't care. People can talk about me as much as they want, and it doesn't really bother me a whole lot. I mean, my worst looking wheat field is along a paved road that everybody drives by all the time, and I'm not proud of it. But at the same time, if we want to be able to have that product to sell, to be able to bring to our customers, because they have been asking for that very specific thing, I have to be willing to go out on a ledge to try it. I have to be willing to fail. You know, just like starting the mill. When we first got this, we had no clue what we were doing. We had no knowledge of how to operate a mill, and we didn't really even know who we could talk to about it. So we were just kind of dipping our toes in the water, trial and error of some different things. And yeah, it's just really that thought process of not being afraid of failure, I guess. Yeah.
Peter, when we were out looking at your oats there and some of your other crops, you mentioned that you have your off-farm job or your part-time gig is selling crop insurance. And I think that gives you a really interesting insight, because you were talking about, I think you work with farmers in like 9 counties in Minnesota and South Dakota. And you have seen that when they have a third crop in that rotation, it really helps. It's almost a form of crop insurance in itself. Can you talk a little bit about that? And because I think that ties into the soil health issue, and obviously soil health is really important when you're starting to diversify into that system. But I think that gives you some really good insights into the value of diversity a little bit.
I've seen the yields that guys get, and knowing that they have that third crop, that small grain in with their corn and beans, you can see a yield bump on their corn and beans, and it's attributable to having that other crop in there. And I think a lot of that in a holistic approach comes from resiliency of the soil, having different biology out there. You're going to have lower disease pressure, lower pests pressure, it creates a different environment out there for those crops to thrive. And that's where I see the added benefit of getting that small grain back in. And that's why I've always wanted to get into that three crop rotation, you know, especially on a conventional side, just because from a soil health standpoint, I know it's better. I've always had that assumption. And now today we're starting to see more research being done on soil health and on resiliency. I mean, we're seeing larger rain events. I don't care whatever you want to call it or what it's due to, it's happening. Mm-hmm. We're seeing, you know, 2-3-4-inch rain events. And I can speak firsthand right here on my farm. I live in a valley, so I have hills on both sides of my house and my field right outside my house. Usually when we get a big rain event, there's water down in the bottom. And now I've experimented with rye as a cover crop following my corn and beans the last couple years, and I've got beans out here this year. And we just came off of back-to-back weekends of 3-inch rains both weekends. Our tile lines are full, our sloughs are full, our ditches were full, everything was full. And that night of the second event, it started raining. I saw the water like a river going through from our hills down to the field. And as it was going dark, I just thought, oh, I'm going to wake up to lakefront property. I just know it.
And
yeah, I didn't have my hip waders on or my arm floaties, you know. It's, we're in the middle of July here, and we shouldn't be this wet kind of a thing. But no, all jokes aside, I woke up the next morning, and I looked in a rain gauge, and we had almost 2 3/4 inches of rain. And I looked out in the field, and there was not a drop of water standing out there. And our beans aren't that tall. It's been cool here this summer, but yeah. I should have seen water out there standing. I don't have a tile intake in that field. It's all seepage. Between, I think, the cover crops and building that soil resiliency up with some seepage drainage, I think that that was able to handle it. And I didn't lose any beans out there. There's no yellowing of beans. In other years, it would have killed the beans. So I'm starting to become a more and more of a believer, I guess, in not just a three-crop rotation, but even cover cropping, somehow trying to figure out how to get this to fit into our climate, into our region this far north, somehow trying to do something to build more soil resiliency for our changing weather conditions that we have.
Peter, you had made the point earlier that because you're direct marketing what you're processing, what you're growing and processing here, there is a reason that not more people, the marketing, you can't just take these specialty grains to the local elevator here. The system isn't set up for that. And if you are raising conventional wheat, and I think you had experience with this, it's just getting dumped in with other wheat, even though you're raising a really quality product. So you are able to raise a quality product and then get that value out of it by direct marketing it. And I think you kind of ran through like a comparison of if you were taking your maybe conventional wheat to the elevator, how much you'd be getting for it, and kind of you were saying we're standing in the middle of a field here that this is how much it's worth per bushel. I don't want everybody to think that that's immediately what's going to happen. Obviously, you guys have done all the background work on doing the processing and everything, but I think it's a good comparison of what can happen maybe when you take this route a little bit.
So really, like I mentioned before, it's all about trying to get that return on investment, trying to make it worth my time from a value standpoint, and how can I add that value? So it took some thinking outside the box, and like I said before, not being afraid to fail. So that's where the concept of, well, let's buy a mill and do it ourselves, you know, because we, neither one of us had ever dreamt of having a mill. Like, you go to the store to buy your flour, right? That's right. Just what you do. So when I pitched this idea, like, I had to sell myself on it first before I told Brittany about it. And when I told her about it, she just really gave me this look like, what? Like, you can't do that. You don't mill your own grain. And so it, you know, it just takes some of that outside of the box thinking to try to add value to whatever you're doing. It's no different than the people who are selling beef or pork or chicken right off their farm direct to consumer. We're just doing it with small grains, mm-hmm. Processing it into flour. It's not easy. I'm not going to try to scare people away, but I also don't want everybody to jump into it thinking, oh, hey, I just need to go buy a mill and I'm going to make a bunch of money, because there are risks to it. It's been a huge learning curve. We had some wheats, like I said, we had vomitoxin. Some wheats we were able to remove the vomitoxin and salvage some of the wheat for milling for food grade. Some of it had vomitoxin levels that were so high we couldn't salvage any of it. Well, that's either going to be seed for a future year or it just goes to be animal feed. So you're going to have some grain that you can add value to and some grain that you're not. I guess you just have to know all the risks going into it that, yes, you can add value, and just kind of do your homework, do some research, and knowing how far you can take that. I guess when we started this, we kind of backed into it a little bit, and I didn't realize how much value we could add to it and how broad the markets were going to be. I was thinking it was just going to be flour and flour only. I didn't realize how many people owned their own tabletop mill and wanted just the wheat berries. Oh. So we have people that'll buy, you know, 10 pounds of wheat berries or a 30-pound bucket of wheat berries from us that they mill in their own kitchen on their own, because they understand the value of fresh milled and the flavor that comes from fresh milling. And so that kind of opened my eyes to a whole different world out there as well. How big is that market? I have no idea. I just know that we've tapped into it a little bit here, and we're going to see how far it can take us.
Do you have a rough idea of that, how much value you are adding to a bushel of, say, wheat by doing something like this, as opposed to if you were just sending conventional wheat to the elevator, that kind of thing?
If you figure out per pound or per bushel, it adds quite a bit to it. But then when you think about how much you're touching it and the process that's involved with it, I guess I haven't done the math to it yet to see what my return per hour
yeah.
would be, or the infrastructure. Yeah. I mean, what kind of a payback is there to it? We're just now starting a remodel process on the farm of building a permanent mill facility and storage facility right on the farm. So, you know, we're looking at investing tens of thousands of dollars just in infrastructure, and then you start adding some specialized equipment in there. The numbers start to get pretty big pretty fast. Mm-hmm. And when you start talking about selling a 5-pound bag of flour, it kind of makes you wonder in the back of your head, why am I doing this? But then when you start adding this 5-pound bag of flour with that 5-pound bag of flour, and then that baker orders 200 pounds, and then this company is going to order 2,000 pounds, and you start adding it all together, well, now you can start to pay some bills. I guess deep down in my heart, I know it's the right thing to do. Financially, I'm not sure. Time will tell. But I know that it's a way that I am able to afford having that third crop in my rotation. And at the end of the day, that's really what I want. I want that diversity in my crop rotation, and I want to provide a healthy product that's nutritional, high in nutritional value for people to eat. Even if we didn't have a mill, I still want to know in the back of my mind that I'm providing something for somebody that's going to help make their life better.
For somebody who was looking to get into raising small grains, obviously the whole processing, having your own product end is not for everybody, but if that's something that they're interested in, I guess what are some suggestions you would have? You guys have had to overcome some challenges. You know, we're not saying this is the model to go after or whatever, but if somebody was just trying to diversify into some small grains, and like I said, both on the raising end of it, but also on that other end of it, of maybe going all the way to processing it.
I would suggest networking, trying to talk to as many people as you know that are currently doing it, or, you know, if you've got a grandparent or a neighbor who is maybe either retired from farming or that you know had small grains back in the day, pick their brain. Ask them tons of questions, because the old guys, that's what they used to do before we had the chemicals to kill weeds and to spray fungicides and insecticides out there. They had to have that third crop to break that cycle down. They have a lot of working knowledge and as to why and how that works. So just do a lot of talking, ask a lot of questions, try to find positive people to talk to, because there are negative people out there. We've had people tell us, oh, this isn't going to work. Oh, you shouldn't try that. Well, I don't know why you're growing small grains. You're never going to make money at it. Well, yeah, you might be right, but I'm still going to do it. You know, you have to be resilient. You have to have some thick skin. You have to be willing to try. And even if you fail the first time, maybe there's something that you could do different. Maybe there was something you overlooked. I went to a lot of different events that were put out by various organizations, trying to listen to other farmers who've done stuff with cover cropping, with small grains. I've attended webinars, do some internet research, you know, whatever you can to try to piece together the information that you need. Because what I do here in Western Minnesota is going to be completely different than somebody does in Kansas or Washington or New York. Yeah, we're all farmers. We're all growing wheat, but we're all going to do it differently, because even my soil type here on my farm is different than 20 miles away. So what works for me isn't going to be what works for somebody else, but I maybe have an idea, or you could take a concept of what I'm doing and alter it to fit what you're trying to do.
Brittany, any thoughts on that? What you suggest to somebody that's especially kind of the more, let's make this a food product kind of end of it?
I would say start small, but dream big, and be ready to be flexible, because our first farmers, we launched our sales in May. That's not a prime baking time. You know, yeah. Fall and winter are prime baking times. You know, so it's going to be kind of hard to sell flour in the summer. And so one of my brothers said, you know, Brittany, I don't know the last time I bought a bag of flour. If you have a brownie mix, I like brownies. I will be a repeat customer. You know, and so it was like, good tip. Let's take our flour, develop a brownie mix, maybe develop a pancake mix. We're still getting nourishing product in people's hands. It's just a little different form. And we might even be hitting more people because not everyone wants to bake the bread, wants to make the cookies. But if we can give them a mix where they add a few ingredients to, they're all for it. So that's where the flexibility came in. Like, have your vision, have your goals, but listen to your consumers also and see if their ideas fit your business plan and fit your brand.
When we were out earlier looking at your crops, I think I wrote down, you mentioned at least twice, maybe more than that, that you love to experiment, Peter. So my question for both of you is, what are you looking at? I know you're just trying to get through some of the stuff you're doing now, so that's especially here in the middle of the growing season. But when you have a minute to think, what are some future plans, kind of looking years down the where would you like to be in 5-10 years type of thing? What would be the ideal situation?
I would love a commercial kitchen, and not just a commercial kitchen, but one that has space to do cooking classes or even just host tours so that groups can come out. Depending on the time of the year, we can look at the field, but either way, we can show them the wheat berries. Then they can watch it go through the mill. We can take that freshly milled flour and turn it into pizza crusts and make pizzas or, you know, whatever we're making that day, pretzels, you know, whatever, but they get to see the whole process. Here's the product right from the field. We milled this 5 minutes ago. Let's mix it up, bake it, and eat it all within an hour. I think that would just be awesome.
One of the things, and this was even before I was married, I always thought it'd be so cool to have a restaurant, like grow the potatoes to make the French fries from,
right.
You know, and have some milk cows to get the dairy products from, and just have a restaurant where everything I sold in a restaurant was stuff that I grew on my farm. Now, granted, I don't have the man hours or the labor to be able to do stuff like that, but I just always thought, oh, that'd be so cool. I think I've shared that with my wife once or twice, like, oh, that would just be fun. Like, it'd be so cool to have this restaurant and then be able to show a video while people are eating of us growing it and harvesting it and processing it, you know, everything, like, show them this is where your food came from. Like, it didn't just appear on the store shelf or something like that, or we didn't just pull it out of the freezer and back or something. So that's just something between us. This is the first time I've ever verbalized it to anybody other than my wife, honestly. But it's been, and don't expect it anytime soon, listeners. But it's been really cool because as the mill has grown, our kids now are starting to think bigger picture. Our oldest boy is 9, and then we have a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old, and then a little girl who's just 15 months. But the boys, especially the older ones, are really starting to get into this. So that's kind of fun. They're like, well, you know what? If we're going to build this mill facility, maybe you could have like a little room on the side where you sell the flour in. Yeah, and then you could do the brownie mixes there too. And oh, why don't we sell our eggs there? So we could have this storefront. Yeah, and then Mom, you like to bake, so why don't you bake bread and we could sell bread in there too? And oh yeah, you know, so they just start feeding off each other, and to see their minds just really grow with the possibilities that you can have off of just one idea, that's exciting to me. I'm not trying to push this on them. I'm not doing something so that my kids have a job to do in the future. That's not my goal, but it's just fun for me to see them be creative and to see their minds turn, even at their young ages, to have that creativity and that mindset of, I can do this. Mm-hmm. I can create something. You know, we'll do something that others can enjoy. That's just been fun.
For more on Sand Hill Mill and integrating small grains into a cropping operation, including details on LSP workshops related to the topic, see the podcast page for Ear the Ground episode 377 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendell, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.